Welcome everyone to this interview where I'm super excited to be talking with my good friend Matthias Barker, where we're going to be exploring anxiety, particularly in the context of relationships, co-regulation, and ultimately how we can better understand our anxiety, but also find effective paths to healing and transformation. To give you a little bit of Matthias's background, Matthias Barker is a licensed mental health counselor specializing in the treatment of complex trauma, childhood abuse, and marital issues. He holds a master's degree in clinical mental health counseling from Northwest University and is currently located in Nashville, Tennessee. Matthias is widely recognized for his unique approach to making mental health knowledge and skills accessible to the wider public. Matthias delivers psychoeducational content to a following of over 5 million people. His innovative blend of engaging content and relevant mental health advice has fostered a vibrant online community centered on healing, personal growth, and moving toward meaning in the midst of hardship. So firstly, welcome, Matthias.
Yeah, so glad to be here. It's great to see you again, Alex. How are you doing?
Yeah, good. I always enjoy our conversations. So why don't we start with just giving some definitions of what we're talking about here? So we've got anxiety, we've got fear, we've, you know, trauma in this mix. So how would you differentiate and distinguish and define particularly anxiety?
Yeah. So anxiety is specifically about something I don't have certainty about, something that's either coming in the future or something that's happening in someone else's brain, right? And so I think that's really kind of how I couch it. So fear would be, you know, I'm getting chased by a bear right now, so I'm terrified, or someone threw something at me and I'm ducking and I'm scared because I don't know what's going to happen in the present moment. But fear has a lot to do with what's happening in this space that I don't have access to, where I don't have information. And that, of course, would be the future. So I'm scared that, you know, is my boss mad at me? Is he going to fire me tomorrow? Is he going to put this huge project on my shoulders? Am I going to get any sort of support? Is it going to end up great? Or is it actually going to fail? And then that's going to hurt my reputation. So you have all these like predictions about how the future might unfold. But then there's also what's going on in my boss's brain. You know, like, does he like me or not? Does he think I'm capable or not? Does he think I'm going to fail or not? Does he care about, you know, everything else that's on my plate? Is he considering me at all? Like, we don't have access to what's going on in someone else's brain or what's going on in the future. And that's really the domain of anxiety. And the thing that makes it tricky is it has a lot to do with our past experiences and the kinds of predictions that we make about what's going on in the world and then how I might respond in the world. And that is where it has, you know, even a little bit of overlap in the conversation around something like trauma. They hang out, there's a Venn diagram there where they hang out, you know, thematically, because the experiences that we've been through all the way up from childhood into our early adult experiences, into our professional experiences, our educational experiences, our relationship experiences, the breakups you've been through, whatever, they all inform what we think is going to come next. And so if anxiety really is, you know, let's say what's going on in someone's head or what's going on in the future, then when I am on a first date and I'm feeling anxious, I'm kind of importing all these past experiences that I've had on first dates and projecting it out into the future. And then the dysfunction of anxiety is I start to react to what I think is coming next before we get there. And I love this line by a mutual friend of ours, David Kessler. He calls it living in the wreckage of your future.
And that's
it's
great.
So poetic and beautiful.
That's a classic David. I love it.
Right. Yeah. That's so his style. So it's like, oh, they probably think I'm weird. They probably think I'm being awkward. So, right. That's the social anxiety element. If this doesn't go poorly, I'm going to have to sign up for another date. I don't really want to go on those apps. You know, again, like, this is such a nightmare. Like, I'm going to spend all this money on this date and it's not even going to go. Like, so you're already kind of depressed or already kind of like experiencing the rejection before it gets there. And that, I mean, ironically, changes how you interact on the date. You start to become a little bit more withdrawn. You're a bit more guarded. You're not as relaxed. You're not as kind of, I don't know, witty and funny and charming as you normally are, because you're guarded and you're not wanting to say something wrong, which then affects how the date's going. And then the big dysfunction in anxiety is you often get these, what's called a false positive, which means that you read the situation wrong, which makes the whole problem worse. So, for example, in this date, you are reserved, you are kind of held back, and then the other person doesn't text you back and they don't want to set up a second date. And you're like, I knew I was awkward. I knew that I was being weird. Like, I knew that I'm just like a hopeless case, whatever. And that's a false positive because the thing you were doing to try to protect yourself from the fear of getting rejected on this date, being withdrawn, being kind of held back, was actually the thing that contributed to the date not going well. It was kind of like a self-fulfilling prophecy. The thing you were doing to try to stave off the fear made the fear expand and grow. And that is just the conundrum of anxiety, is often the coping mechanisms, the way that we try to stave off the anxiety, that we try to account for what we predict is going to happen, makes it more likely that the negative prediction will come to be.
Yeah, it's like what you're saying is so true. That there's like a confirmation bias, right? That it's like I keep collecting evidence that tells me that that's how it is. But also, it's like there's a confirmation bias that in a way we run anxiety, and the other thing happens that it goes okay, and we think, well, it went okay because I did all that worrying about it. So we
Yes.
have to live in this state to try and fit to find that place of safety.
Yeah, so common. Like, think about germs for folks who maybe have like OCD about germs, which falls into this anxiety camp, right? It's I don't touch any doorknobs and I wash my hands, several dozen times a day, and then you don't get sick and you think, good, it's working. And it's like, well, hey, if you just wash your hands after you go to the bathroom before you eat, you're probably good. You probably wouldn't get sick, at the same success rate. But you take a false positive. You think because I've been dousing my hands in hand sanitizer every few seconds, that's what's keeping me safe. And you get stuck in this cycle, like you're talking about.
One of the things that I think is also important here is that there's a positive intent within the anxiety, right? That there's a reason why we're doing it. And I think part of that reason is that we're trying to get something, right? We're trying to get, for example, a feeling of safety. Like we try to think our way to a feeling of safety. That if I run all these scenarios, if this happens, that happens, I'll do this, I'll do that. And as long as I've thought about it, then I'll be okay. Like we're trying to get something. But of course, it actually takes us further away from the very feeling that we're actually trying to reach.
Yeah. Well, I think when we really put our strategies under, a test, even just for a moment, it starts to reveal that's the case. Like, take what you were just talking about, preparing, let's say, for an argument ahead of time. I don't know if you do this. I do this constantly, where I am anticipating a stressful conversation and I start to imagine how the conversation could go wrong or things they might say. And then I try to prepare for what I'd say back and make sure I have a comeback and then I'm ready. And then if they ask this question, then I'd say this. And it's you're playing out all these scenarios. But then, when you actually start to think about the statistics of the likelihood that they actually would say anything that you're preparing for in the first place, like let's say that you have a statement and they have anything from like five different responses that they could say in, in response to what you said. And then you prepare for those five scenarios. But then, there could be five different ways they respond to each of those five different scenarios. And then five after that. And then before like your three exchanges into the conversation, you're well over 100 different conversations that you're simulating in your mind. And then you get there and they say the one thing you didn't expect them to say. And you're like, God, there's a 3 hours of ruminating, staying up late at night, trying to think about this conversation that went to waste. And it's just not even mathematically possible to really anticipate and run all these simulations. But it is under the guise of like, if I can feel prepared, then I can calm down. And that really is the illusion. It's if I can be in control, then I'll be safe. And we run these simulations, this rumination, to try to run after that feeling of safety, like you're saying. It's a good intent, but
Yeah.
it actually makes us more tired in the conversation, which strangely enough makes the whole problem worse because we're not as sharp-minded because we stayed up all night thinking about it, and we are going in already pretty agitated, kind of vigilant, because I don't know, we're responding to the wreckage of our future before we get there. We're already, in a yelling match with them in our minds before we even start the conversation, which brings us into a kind of a more intense place when we get in there, which likely makes the conversation worse. It's this whole cycle
Yeah.
again. It makes things
But
worse.
as you're talking, it also struck me that in a way, there's also an addictive element to this. And what I mean by that is like adrenaline is a drug, right? And so It's like we worry and it activates our system, and then we get used to being in that activated state. And then in a way, our nervous system normalizes to being in a state of anxiety. Like that becomes our new normal. So I'm curious as to some of the ways that one recognizes and identifies. Maybe someone's watching this interview and they're having that sort of painfully uncomfortable moment where there's sort of realization, like that is what I do. What are some of the things that open up, starting to move and starting to shift what's happening?
Well, I mean, I think in the case of something like generalized anxiety disorder or OCD, which kind of does have this pervasive, kind of always on in the background kind of texture to it, there's a few things we could say there. I think it's a little different for phobias. For example, like if you have a phobia of spiders or if you have a phobia of public speaking, a lot of those folks just avoid the situation entirely and they can live fairly, contented lives, but I'm staying away from anywhere I can see a spider. Or, germs can start to kind of be that way too. People kind of build these insulated worlds around them that satisfy all the, I don't know, compulsions and rules that they have in their heads for what will stay safe. And then they just avoid. That's kind of the common way we cope is we avoid running into the thing that we're scared of, or we try to control and we try to fix, the conversation like we were talking about with the rumination. I think agoraphobia is really similar too. That's a version of avoidance. But in the general sense, for the folks who are just kind of like high strung and anxious, there's two things that pop up as far as like, wait, what do we do about this? One is to acknowledge that much of our anxiety likely has something to do epigenetically with how we were born and our temperament. And this is something that I don't think is talked about super often in therapy world or in conferences like these, is like we come into the world with a whole set of triggers and predispositions of things to be scared of. And that when I learned that and that actually clicked for me, I'm like, oh my goodness, what a relief. Because that can change. Let me tell you how that changes. Because it actually started to click for me watching Planet Earth. I was watching like this little lizard thing like crack out of an egg. And then there was a big, pile of snakes that were all surrounding these eggs, ready to munch on these little lizards. And the lizard popped up and looked around and just took off running and just knew that I'm surrounded by predators. And I just had this thought. I'm like, who told that lizard that snakes were dangerous? Who told that lizard to run away, go to high ground? It was almost like the lizard just leaped into action. And I also, dove deeper into this and found there's tons of studies, around, for example, taking little mice or rats and exposing them to like the smell of cats and noticing that even though a mouse or a rat had never seen a cat before, it went into threat and was just like on high alert. And then it's like, well, why did that happen? It's because the genetics passed down from generations of mice, and rats said, like, hey, you need this software essentially to flip on if you smell cat, and cats are dangerous. And even though you've never exposed that mice to a cat before, it knows be on high alert. Humans work the same kind of way. We all know people who are like way more scared of spiders than other people, right? There's always someone in the house who's in charge to kill the spider, at least in my house.
In
Like,
my house,
I'm
it's me. I don't
the
know
guy.
about you in your
That's
house.
you. Okay, that's me too. Like for whatever reason, I guess my wife's ancestors were much more, prone to spider attacks than I was. But it's like there are people who just have predispositions. We know this on a personality level. There's people who have higher traits of neuroticism. We kind of use that as an insult now. If you're neurotic, no one likes being called that. But on the academic side of things, that people just kind of have. Let's say they're like their smoke alarms for things that are dangerous, just kind of set at a more sensitive level. They're kind of more vigilant. They're just more on alert. And that's not even a negative trait, so to speak. Like, I mean, you need some of those people who are high alert around you because you'll be safer. They're the one to notice when things are going wrong first. And, that's good. But so to go in and just have a little bit of grace for yourself and be like, okay, this isn't just maybe your choice to be this, high strung. This isn't like an aspect of your character, like you're a coward or something, or you're just, high maintenance, or you're just anxious. It's like, you have millions of ancestors that have contributed to the kind of genetic makeup you have, and those smoke alarms can be recalibrated. And there's tons of studies that show that you give a mouse that cat pheromone over and over and over, and you have it in a safe environment, it's not getting, chewed up. Then the pheromone has a lesser effect. And we call that habituation. We call that extinction. There's lots of psych terms for it. Over and over, those cats calm down. Go on, but
I want to come back to that in a minute, and particularly in terms of how we dial down that smoke alarm. But I actually just want to dive into something a bit more that you just said, because what you said just struck me that there can be a lot of shame around anxiety, right? And, you know, someone has issues, many of the issues one can have in life are visible to the outside world. But particularly if someone has high functioning anxiety, they can look totally fine to everyone else. But on the inside, right, like there's significant distress that's happening. And if there's shame about that, it makes it much harder to seek help and to talk to other people. So I'd love you just to speak a little bit to just perhaps partly normalizing that people have that experience, but also sort of how that sort of shame can be so unhelpful in this situation.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. I mean, you avoid when you're shameful. You avoid things that that remind you of that shame. And, you know, like I was just saying, the thing that actually rewires the smoke alarms is exposure to the thing that you're scared about. And then you realize you're okay. So the mouse is like, oh, I smell the cat, but I'm not getting attacked. That's the way you untangle fear, is you go into scenarios that you predict are going to be really awful. And then you experience safety. And so if you don't, you know, expose yourself to those kinds of situations, if you don't press on into the fear, the anxiety, but you try to mask it, you try to put it away, you try to bottle it up. I mean, it turns into all sorts of pretty terrible things pretty quick. I mean, that can turn into body pain and somatic stuff like fibromyalgia and autoimmune. Not that it creates those things, but it can certainly antagonize it. And
sure.
Some people theorize that it actually impacts the way that those genes can express, right? So that can get really tricky quick. It can turn into depression. I mean, that's why tons of people have combos of anxiety and depression, because what are you depressing? You were pressing down the fear and probably a lot of the grief and loss because you're avoiding so many different things, right? It's like, if I'm anxious around friendships, then I'm lonely. If I'm anxious around people, then I don't have meaningful relationships in my life, or at least not a lot of them. And of course you'd feel depressed. We're social mammals that need people in our lives. And then it's just you and your dog, and dogs are great. Don't get me wrong. Like, thank God for dogs, but you are meant to live with vulnerable, deeply interconnected relationships as a core fiber of the fabric of your life. And so many anxious people feel deep loneliness, which then just kind of, I don't know, calcifies into a depressed, low mood that just feels like it just, you can't get rid of it. And that's because you're avoiding the terrifying stuff. And we feel tons of shame, but then we also feel shame about our shame, which pushes the shame even deeper. Yeah, that's the thing about anxiety. It's the same cycle that we were talking about.
Well,
self-reinforcing.
Yeah, and just to sort of amplify that a bit further, right? It's like someone can have their anxiety, and then they have that shame around it. Then they have an anxiety of what people would think if they saw the shame, right? So it just keeps on feeding itself.
Yeah. You need to go face the cats. You know, it's
well, talking of facing the cats. So we've got a couple of metaphors here. We got our cat smell. We've also got our smoke detectors. So how do we, you touched on it, but let's open it up a little bit more in terms of how we can work to dial down the smoke detector. So you mentioned one of the things is exposure to the thing, because in a way that breaks the narrative, like the story that we have gets challenged in a way in there. But sometimes people have it's like there's so much fear about being exposed to the thing that they become avoidant. So how do we start to either build the courage or change the narrative or sort of do it gently? But what are the ways that can help us start to move towards rather than keep moving away from and reinforcing that narrative?
Well, there's two extremes that don't work. And one is avoiding the thing we're scared of. And the other is jumping in the deep end and getting overwhelmed again. That actually makes it worse. So you don't tell a mouse, go hang out with cats, because cats do bite, you know, and so.
And they do eat mice. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, like, so hey, watch out, you know, so there is almost this middle ground of having kind of these bite-sized pieces of the thing that you're afraid of within a context of safety. And that's the same thing that heals trauma, by the way. And that's why there's this overlap in trauma and anxiety world. It's not simply realizing that there was nothing to be scared of. There probably was something to be scared of. Like, rejection does hurt. You know, germs do cause illness, you know, but you need to kind of update the understanding. Often these beliefs, these predictions are formed early on in our lives, very, very young. So kind of stepping away from the epigenetic thing onto just our life experiences, we kind of come up with these conclusions when we're 3, 4, 5, 6 years old, and it's like they never get updated. So think about like a phone, you know, like I have my iPhone. If you have ever like had like the outdated software and you're trying to like get onto your app or something, and then it keeps crashing. And then what's the first thing you do? You look and see, is my software updated? Because it's like all the apps that I use on my phone that I use to navigate my life are all working off of current day software. And if I have old, outdated software, nothing in my life is going to work too good, because it wasn't made for that. And I think a lot of us find that the app is crashing. You know, we don't feel like our relationships are clicking. We're not advancing in our career. We don't feel connected to our kids. We whatever. And so the question I ask is like, are you working off of outdated software? And so what that could look practically is something like being bullied in school, and then realizing like I can't tell jokes because I'll get made fun of. So I'm just gonna take my sense of humor and my charm and just close it up, and I'm just gonna kind of be in the background and try not to draw attention to myself. And then you're like, oh, I feel really lonely. And it's like, well, you're working off of fifth grade software. You know, this is an old idea. This is a new. Freud called this a fixation. I mean, like, you know, this has been at the very beginning. We've had theories around why we do this, and that's like, it's like a part of how we interact with the world got stunted. It like stopped developing. There's this idea because it gets stuck in this self-reinforcing cycle, like we were just talking about. And if it's working, why update it, right? So I don't tell jokes. I don't get made fun of. It's working, and then we just don't really push it any further. But then it's like, oh man, well, why am I lonely? Why don't I have good relationships? You need to update that. And that includes risking telling a joke. But then I don't tell someone to go do stand up and then bomb on stage and then get socially rejected. It's these small little moments, these little windows of opening up to the thing you're afraid of, but then realizing that I'm accepted and brought in warmly. So it's like, what would it look like to have just like these small little gestures, just a little bit of wit with some of your close friends, and then just see what happens? And to kind of open up kind of layer by layer, moment by moment. And you know, the classic example of this, something we call exposure therapy. You know, I remember a colleague tell me about a kid he was working with who was afraid of dogs. And you know, what they did is they went to the animal shelter, and they held like this little puppy, like just newborn, tiny little pudgy potato looking thing, you know. And the kid would hold that and then come back the next week, and the dog was just a little bit bigger, and then come back the next week and just a little bigger. And it's like you have these safe experiences with that dog, and it slowly, like kind of edge by edge, kind of like starts to bring you into, wait a minute, I'm playing with a full-grown animal, when before I wouldn't even get near one. And that's not because like it's not just that you kind of got used to it. It's like you had enough experiences that kind of rewired that threat response, that sometimes just even in the back of your brain, it's not even like a decision you make up here. It's just kind of your innate, we call it implicit, you know, kind of reactions. It rewires some of these lessons and updates how you interact with the world. It brings the software update back to current day. And the mature response for a dog is something like, you should be a little bit watchful if it's an unknown dog, kind of like if you're walking on the sidewalk and you see its owner. If the owner is like kind of anxiously pulling the leash back, kind of worried as you approach, you know, you probably shouldn't get too close to that dog. But if it's an old guy and the dog's not even on a leash and he's like, oh yeah, that's, you know, that's Squiggles and she's fine, you know, then it's like, okay, maybe there's, but then you kind of just put your hand out, let him smell, kind of see how, what happens if the dog's yapping and barking, you pull back. And so there is this mature understanding of something like attuned trust, like I'm paying attention and I'm using my adult brain to maneuver this situation instead of relying on fifth grade brain. And fifth grade brain just says, avoid it entirely. So that's a little bit of the process that can look different in all sorts of different circumstances, though.
One of the things that can get in the way, one of the things that can get in the way of taking those initial steps is fear, right? We're talking about anxiety. You mentioned that fear is like the things actually happening. And if there's that learned history, that it starts to feel like, okay, I have fear in my body right now. What helps navigate that initial step? So
Yeah.
if one can see that they need to have that exposure and they need to sort of challenge that those stories, but in that moment of taking that step, that first step forward rather than pulling away, what helps us make that move?
Yeah, I think it's finding ways to calm your body down after exposing yourself to the scary thing. And I mean, people have a lot of different words for this. Maybe it's grounding, maybe it's self-care, maybe it's whatever. Thing I always kind of point people to is the most grounding thing you can do is find yourself in a safe relationship. And I think co-regulation with other nervous systems is kind of how we're biologically wired. There's some things that are just scary, especially the old stuff, like that we kind of need someone else's nervous system to help us out. And at the very least, that can be an animal. I think that, oh my gosh, like I was saying, thank God for dogs. Like having your dog on your lap, going for a walk, if you have a romantic partner, like holding their hand, having them rub your back. If you have a friend, just being in their presence, them physically, something like, a warm hug really does bring the body down in ways that I just think like some of the mindfulness techniques, you just need a lot more gas behind the mindfulness techniques than you do the
Yeah.
relationships. Right? That's been my personal experience.
It,
Even for
it,
people who aren't super touchy. What do you think about that?
yeah, no, I was just thinking. So if our kids are upset or distressed in some way, our dogs literally go and sit on them and snuggle into. They even lick their tears away. It's very, very cute. But it's like there's a sort of it's like it's meeting that place inside of us that just needs to be seen and needs to be loved and held as we are, right? And then, as you say, there's also the physical piece of actually feeling our body and coming into our body, because there's that co-regulation and there's that contact. Of course, one of the challenges can be that if someone has had a lifelong struggle with anxiety, then actually that can lead to them becoming more avoidant in relationship, right? That it's like the trigger for the anxiety is emotional connection and intimacy. And so the thing that one most needs is also the thing that one is pushing away.
Yeah, I think this is deeply intuitive when you really start to think about it. It's kind of how humans have always dealt with anxiety. Like something that I got really curious about a couple years ago was like I've been reading a lot of psychology textbooks, but I wonder if there's ways that humans have always done it. Like what were people 1,000 years ago doing about anxiety? What were people 2,000 years ago doing about anxiety? And there's a killer book by a guy named Henry Ellenberger who just does a history of psychiatry. It's a long, big, thick book, but his first chapter is all kind of like these anthropologists exploring all these kind of like native cultures and kind of folks like what were their essentially their ways of trying to help mental health. And when you kind of go into kind of old world cultures, a lot of it is kind of wrapped up in their mythology, right? It's wrapped up in kind of like rituals and the gods and spirits and stuff like that. But what's super common is things like dance. And if there was someone who was anxious, and let's say, the tribe attributed that to like an evil spirit or something. How did they fix it? They had the whole tribe dance around them. There was kinds of massage. There was like rituals where people would gather around and they'd put their hands on them. And like, of course that would help someone who's feeling anxious, like that makes complete sense. Or there would be ways of making them sweat and giving them a hot bath and they would be bathed by, like different elders in the community. And I'm like, oh yeah, that would totally help someone who's like really nervous and fearful. And it just seemed like all of us, as humans, no matter the culture, wherever we grew up, whatever our beliefs are, all have this deep human intuition that the thing that calms down the fear is being connected and being in safe relationship and submitting yourself to the care of other people. And I think that's what we do in our culture is therapy, right? So in our Western worlds, like we have therapists and we have maybe if you go to church or if you have a coach, like there is people in our lives that we put in these positions of leadership, and we have family and we have loved ones, but we need to lend ourselves to the care of other people to bring us into that place of safety. So it's this mixture of facing the thing that we're scared of in small bits. And that's everything from having a hard conversation with our spouse that we're kind of avoiding because we're scared they're going to react, or something down to a spider phobia, or just kind of the general sense of high strungness that I have in whatever area. So I pick something, so I don't just do it in a diffuse way. I don't just do anxiety, like pick something specific. When I was nervous about driving, to work Thursday, when that red Jeep cut me off, and then I was agitated for the rest of the day. And it's like, how do I deal with that anxiety of driving? And it's something like bringing other people into those experiences and having lots of safe driving experiences again
Yeah.
and feeling safe and calm while doing the thing that's kind of scary. That's the whatever version of that, whatever steps you want to put into that, that's the general thrust that I see.
You know, as you were talking, I was remembering a time in my own life, sort of 17, 18 years ago, where I was someone who, particularly back then, was very much like, you know, I do it on my own. So I was living by myself and, you know, working for myself and having, you know, quite a lot of difficult sort of kind of inner kind of processing stuff that was going on. And what I needed was to be around people. But I had all of these narratives around, I don't want to be dependent, I'm fine by myself, they won't understand what's going on, I won't have enough space. So there's all this kind of stuff that's kind of in the way. And then I ended up moving into a shared house with people I didn't particularly know. And it was like within days, like my whole system just settled. It was like, and it wasn't having like big, deep, meaningful conversations or being in, it was just having living bodies around that just gave that sense of co-regulation, that sense of community, that sense of connection. And so I just really wanted to sort of amplify part of what you're pointing to here, which is that the anxiety, we try to solve anxiety from the perspective of anxiety, right? Like we see the world through the lens of our anxiety. And then it's from that place we try and fix it with all of the caveats and rules and limitations that are created. And somehow to really get what we need, we have to drop that story in the first place.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. The way I'd summarize that is we try to either avoid it or control it. Those are the two solutions anxiety loves. Let's avoid it or control it. And the actual thing that untangles the web is something like connection and holding it without control, but in small pieces that don't completely overwhelm us. And that progressively does lead you into something like,
Yeah. Of course, one of the dynamics that can also happen here as well is that we can set our life up in such a way that we're always the one that takes care of everyone else, right? Like if we've got a sort of people pleaser, helper kind of pattern. So we have lots of people in our lives, but actually there's not reciprocity in those relationships. And so we'll say, well, what it will feel like is the love, the support, holding that we need isn't really there. And we feel like the kind of victim of that, but we often fail to see that we've actually been the architect of attracting those kinds of people into our lives, resonating with that dynamic, and actually in a way promoting more of that.
Yeah, people pleasing is just, I'll connect if I feel in control. That's it. And it's through appeasement. So it's not maybe the narcissistic path is to try to get everyone on my narrative. The people pleasing path is to get on everyone else's narrative, you know, and to appease someone else. So that's another control strategy. I also hear, you know, that a potential person saying, well, I'm introverted, so I don't actually think the social stuff makes me more anxious. What do I do? And I would say, really the only social connection that makes anyone anxious, extroverted or introverted, is unsafe, you know, social connection. There's a lot of anxiety around what they're thinking, right? Because that's another domain of anxiety is, what are they thinking? Am I coming off too much? Am I burdening them? Are they thinking that I'm kind of just being, I don't know, a little bit of a wimp, someone who's making too big of a deal out of this, being too dramatic? Are they going to want to overstay their welcome? You know, because another part is like, I think a lot of introverts, they do need social connection just as much as anyone, but just in smaller doses. Come over for an hour, not the whole evening. Come over for an evening just once a week, not four times a week, you know? And so it's like, there is a dosage thing there, but there's no one alive, I think, that just doesn't want any social connection. Even the hermits, that's trauma, like guys, you know? So it is that whatever dose your personality needs, safe connection that is going to bring about what we're talking about.
Yeah. And what I just was just thinking as you were speaking there is it's knowing that you can say when it's time for someone to leave, right? It's like saying no or saying enough, like effectively being able to place a boundary and to know that you can do that. It's much easier to let someone in if you know you can ask them when it's time to leave.
Yeah, that's right. And that takes a certain amount of courage. And then to watch them warmly receive you and be okay with that is that corrective experience like we're talking about. That's like, oh, I put myself out there to say, hey, I think I'm good. I'm going to go to bed early tonight. And they're like, great. I love spending time with you. That kind of changes the way you predict it happened. One other nuance I'll throw in here for panic disorders, because this is a little different with panic, is Pangsept, Jörg Pangsept. He's a neuroscientist that really kind of started to map out the emotional pathways of the brain. And he theorized that grief and panic share the same neural networks. Much of the same neural kind of like roads in the brain are shared. And theorized that panic is mostly related to something like separation anxiety and fear of disconnection. So maybe you could think something like loss and shame, whatever kind of blend of those two that is unique to your situation. And I think that the same thing is actually what untangles panic, even though it doesn't feel self-evident. Because you're like, how can me being scared of airplanes be connected to some sort of need for social whatever? And it's often symbolic. I mean, and this kind of gets into how you see these things. The way I see it is like something like fear of driving, fear of airplanes, panic that's related to even needles has a lot more to do with what does it look like to be contained? Okay. Like on a plane, what does it look like to feel trapped and you have no options? Have you ever had an experience in your life where you felt trapped, isolated, like you had no options, and you were separated from the person who was going to make you feel safe? Whether that's a parent, whether that's an experience in your adult life. Needles, what does it look like to have something intruding into your body? To have a foreign agent pressed in a way that's vulnerable and kind of scary? What does that look like? Germs, same kind of thing. So I hold that OCD can be based in trauma. I think the same kind of thing there. Like what does that tell you about how your childhood experiences prepared you for connection, vulnerability, and just your own mortality? What does it look like to fear death and to fear sickness and to be feeble? All that stuff is really rich therapeutic content. I can't cover all my bases in a 40-minute talk, but I'd put that in the same camp.
Yeah, I hear you. Matthias, someone that's watching this, that's thinking, okay, I'm hearing you, more social connection, more le less extremes of sort of avoidance and sort of forcing and so on. Where do people start? What's a few practical steps that folks can start with to start to reverse the experience or to sort of move away from anxiety and into a new place?
Great question. I'll give you an exercise that you can do now, and then I'll put the caveat that I have an anxiety workshop where I put tons of different exercises and stuff like that on MatthiasJBarker.com. That's my shameless plug. Okay. Anxiety workshop with lots of
I'm going to
quizzes.
invite you for an even more shameless one in a few minutes,
That's fine.
but
Okay, well that's there. So I guess I think this is important to actually have grounded exercises. So something I'll just tell you to do right now is like write down verbatim some of the things that you're really nervous about. And so much of anxiety is getting close enough to the scenarios where the catastrophes are worried will happen, but just getting far enough away. It's like, how can I get close enough to controlling it to where I start to feel calm without actually going all the way there? And I think that journaling, being forced to put things into a timeline, putting script, writing the script down that you're worried that is going to happen, it just starts to tax you. It's just a little bit challenging. And then you can kind of like see it from a different perspective. It's like, in the acceptance and commitment therapy world, they call this diffusion. It's like when, if you can kind of start to pull back and get out from the anxiety itself. In IFS world, they call it blended. Like, so if you can get unblended from this experience and kind of start to look at it from the outside, then it starts to sober you up emotionally. I like that metaphor for it. It's like if you're on alcohol and you're drunk, you don't know what's going on. You're all wobbling around. But the moment you sober up, you can see your actions more clearly. And I think that ways that we can do that in a self-guided way would be things like journaling, to be able to write down, here's what I'm anxious about. Here's what I'm worried is going to happen. Here's verbatim the thing that I think is going to happen and go wrong. Okay. Then rereading through that, sometimes with a different colored pen, different colored marker, and just making comments on that like you were reading the story of someone else. Like if you happened upon your son's journal, your spouse's journal, someone that you care about, your brother's journal, and you were reading this, what would occur to you to be grounded in reality? And then what would occur to you to be, let's say, exaggerated, or there's an extra 10, 20% on top that perhaps is a bit more inflated? And that's not just to criticize yourself. That's to then bring you back down into kind of a sober place. That's updating the software, so to speak, in your thinking. A lot of people criticize some of the CBT kind of more like cognitive oriented therapies when it comes to anxiety. But when you're doing interventions that are trying to change what you believe about something, you are interacting with core memories and core learning. This gets a little bit nerdy, but like our beliefs are built upon our experiences. So some people like to go right for the experiences, like through something like EMDR or some trauma therapy to like, let's heal the old childhood memories. And some people go straight for the beliefs, which you could think of as kind of like the result of the memories. It's the thing on top, and change the beliefs and kind of go through it, through the front door, not the back door. So all those are fine in my book. I just think that something self-guided to do would be get that safe connection, journal it down, maybe with two different colored pens, just to start to evaluate it. Maybe read it with a friend. I think that watching the facial expressions of somebody that is reading that piece of paper and starting to get even a social reference for what is grounded and what is not. As vulnerable as that is, as anxiety is provoking as that can be, is so helpful. I think so much of the way that I calm my own anxiety personally is just conversations with my wife where I run her through the catastrophes and go into my head. And then I'm watching her as she's like, and we have enough trust. We have enough safety to where I can take that in. I don't get defensive. I'm just like, what is normal? And then what parts are over the top? And then she says, well, I mean, this part, yeah, that makes sense. Like that is a little bit nerve wracking. And it's probably not going to end in this way, or you would probably recover it, even if it did go wrong. There's probably some choices that you have, even if things did go wrong, that you end up being okay. And I, again, we regulate with other people and by diffusing from getting outside of that whirlwind. I don't think we solve it from within it. I don't know anyone who solved it from within it. We have to get outside of it.
Yeah. You know, it's fine. I'm sure my wife wouldn't mind me sharing the story. Just reminded me of a funny one where, you know, she's someone that can definitely get in her head. And she was got herself into a massive anxiety that it was something like this, that she was going to have a heart attack, and she was having pain in her chest, and you know, it meant this and meant that, and she had to go to the hospital right away. And it went on. We were sort of talking about it, and I was like, so where is it? And she's like, it's right here. And I was like, darling, your heart's the other side of your chest. It's like,
it's not your heart.
It's like in that moment, it's like all this kind of relief. It's like, but we can do this, that we can get caught up in this like whole story and narrative, and it means this. And sometimes it's just that reality testing. Someone's like, no, hey, like that. I'm not saying we don't need to get it checked out at some point, but like what you've made it in your head is not actually the reality of what's going on here.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Sometimes we need other eyeballs on our problems to sober up.
Yeah.
It's a huge problem.
So Matthias, you mentioned, and very quickly, I'm going to let's take a bit more space to it. So website, you mentioned that you've got an anxiety course. Tell people about that.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So MatthiasJBarker.com, you can get the anxiety course there. I really kind of dive into understanding those cycles, those self-reinforcing loops. And that course is very much focused on relational conflict as well. So it's kind of focused on like the anxiety that we feel in confronting someone and having hard conversations. And I notice that folks with anxiety also have a hard time with relationships most of the time, because folks who have great, safe, good relationships, just by proxy, do better with their anxiety. So like, it's just kind of two things that, you know, we call it comorbidity in the psych world, but they just kind of go together, is often anxiety and not feeling safe in your close relationship. So I try to kind of tackle both of those in the same course. And, yeah, there's exercises, a workbook that's really dynamic in there for understanding that cycle. If you can identify that cycle, then you can step outside of it. That's been my goal in that workshop. So yeah, that's what I'd say.
Awesome. And also people should check out Matthias on social media as well. Instagram, all the usual places. He has the following that we all wish to have in terms of success there. So he has amazing short form videos that really unpack this stuff. So just want to make sure people check that out as well. So Matthias, thank you so much. Really appreciate you, and I appreciate your time.
Yes. Thanks for having me.